Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with an analysis of the latest deadlock in Washington as House Republicans refuse to go along with a bipartisan Senate bill passed 89-10 that would extend the payroll tax cut for 2 months. Washington Post columnist and executive editor of The American Prospect, Harold Meyerson, joins us to explore the motives of House Republicans who once again will not accept compromise unless all of their demands are met. Then, with our intelligence community knowing very little about North Korea's leadership and uninformed speculation continuing in the press, we get a very different analysis of North Korea from B.R. Myers, who was a professor of international studies at Dongseo University in Busan, South Korea, and the author of The Cleanest Race, How North Koreans See Themselves and Why It Matters. He argues that the dynastic dictatorship in North Korea is not a far-left communist regime, but is in fact more of a right-wing fascist monarchy like Imperial Japan was under Emperor Hirohito. Then finally, we will look into what the Iraq War was all about and how one foreigner, who was all the while working for America's most ardent enemy, conned the world's greatest power into a war that it will always regret and continue to lose. Richard Bonin, a five-time Emmy Award-winning producer for 60 Minutes and author of Arrows in the Night, Ahmad Chalajwi's Long Journey to Triumph in Iraq, joins us to tell the tale of the real architect of the Iraq War, who the neocons championed as he manipulated America into an unnecessary and counterproductive war that only he and his Iranian masters benefited from. Joining us now is Harold Meyerson, an opinion writer for The Washington Post, where he writes a weekly political column. He's also the executive editor of The American Prospect and previously was the executive editor of The LA Weekly. Welcome to Background Briefing, Harold Meyerson.
It's a pleasure to be here, Ian.
And once again, we have not so much a government shutdown, but a very uncompromising House caucus that refuses to go along with a bipartisan agreement that the Senate voted on 89-10. And now the president is calling them out, saying this is not poker. They won't take a vote, will they, on this bill?
They will not. They won't vote on the payroll tax deal extension itself because, quite rightly, they think this will render them electorally vulnerable if they vote against it, because this will mean raising taxes of a household, say, that makes $50,000 by $1,000 a year, which will be an amount taken out over one's paychecks. Rather than do that, they passed a resolution demanding that this process go to conference committee. In other words, they know that there was enough risk in their position that they tried to mitigate their position by not voting on the compromise that the Senate had passed itself, but punting, and it pretty much got the same kind of vote. I mean, they got pretty much a party line vote. There were a handful of Republicans who crossed over and voted with the Democrats against setting up yet another conference committee, but only a handful.
Well, it seems, though, that their argument makes absolutely no sense if they're saying that this 2 month extension that costs $33 billion is not enough, and they want to have a year-long extension that would come out at about $200 billion. And all the while, the real argument is about how do you pay for it, and once again, the House Republicans are going to the mat for the millionaires and billionaires.
Yes, but it's actually more than that. To begin with, they Dave Camp, and who heads the House Ways and Means Committee for the Republicans, and others were against extending the payroll tax as recently as 6 weeks ago. Then they switched when they realized this was a politically untenable position. Now they are maximalists on this, but it's not only that they want to avoid the millionaires' surtax, which actually the Democrats have already dropped. That's not part of the compromise. They have appended their own utterly extraneous bill, which is to speed the government's okay of the Keystone XL pipeline, which the Obama administration has shunted off any decision on for over a year. So they have appended what they think is a wedge issue that will they enable them to cast the administration as opposed to job creation, or blacken the administration's name with the environmental community. Actually, the Keystone XL pipeline is going to create about 6,500 construction jobs over a two-year period and maybe 50 jobs thereafter to maintain it. It is hardly a huge, in the national scheme of things, a huge job-generating project, but they think this is will give them some leverage. I might add, I think they're really wrong in terms of the way this is going to play out in public opinion, but we shall see.
But I thought, though, that they were using the Keystone XL pipeline as political cover, because at that point the deadlock was over how to pay for the extension. The Democrats wanted a modest surtax on millionaires and billionaires, and the Republicans rejected that.
The Democrats have already abandoned.
I know they folded. They fold all the time, Harold. there's nothing. But what also is at stake here is an extension of the unemployment insurance benefits and a stopgap measure to prevent automatic cuts to doctors' Medicare payments. But my understanding is that in the House bill, which the House wants the Senate to revisit, which the Senate struck out, the House Republicans put in more poison pills than the XL pipeline. They put in a provision to gut pollution controls and mandate drug tests for those collecting unemployment insurance.
And a provision to cut the maximum time one can receive unemployment insurance from 99 weeks to 59 weeks. So that's a major thing too. Now I'm not sure they really expect to get many of these. They are just their theory is whatever they can throw in the wall, whatever sticks that they can get, they will push for. And it's pretty clear that John Boehner, the House Republican Speaker, did not expect this, but it's also increasingly clear he does not control the caucus. And the number two Republican in the House, Eric Cantor of Virginia, really is the real head of the conservatives. Well, they're all conservatives, of the insane conservatives in the caucus. And that's the majority. And Boehner, who had basically given Mitch McConnell in the Senate carte blanche to cut a compromise, then had to backtrack. And he tried to sell this, apparently, in the phone call to his caucus over the weekend, and he was rebuked by his own caucus.
Well, Boehner apparently originally described the Senate vote as a good deal and a victory in a conference call. And then I guess once he came up against the Tea Party people, he hit this wall. And I thought another part of the reason why they didn't want to vote on it is that they're not really quite sure whether, in fact, they will get a majority. All Democrats, of course, voted against it, but they peeled off a couple, but they may peel off some more. They only need 26.
Right. There are splits in the Republican Party on this, at least four Republican senators, including Richard Lugar, who has been in the Senate forever. Have criticized the House Republicans for not backing the compromise. All four of the senators are up for re-election this year, and there are plenty of House members who might blanch at this as well. And this is in the context of a Gallup poll coming out Monday in which Congress's approval rating was at an absolute all-time low, 11% approval, 86% disapproval. That's really breathtaking.
Well, one of the senators is up for re-election and is vulnerable. Scott Brown in Massachusetts came out very strongly against the Republican House.
Right, as did Dean Heller in Nevada. Lugar is up for re-election. And the fourth, whom I cannot at the moment remember. But, yes, they were all
Olympia
all
Snow,
the four,
yeah.
Yeah, all the four who chastise the House Republicans are up for re-election, and that suggests that there's some trepidation on the Republican side, even in the House, that to be seen as opposing the ongoing reduction of the payroll tax is political bad news.
Well, so is this a case that the feckless Democrats have pulled their chestnuts out of the fire thanks to the inflexibility and the zealotry of these Tea Party Republicans?
It may be. I mean, folks like us have been continually saying the Democrats really have to draw a line and stop caving. And I think they may have reached the point. Harry Reid has sent the Senate home. Barack Obama says this is it. They got to pass what the Senate passed, or the consequences will follow, and the Democrats will run on this issue. And I think the Democrats have decided that this is something of a win-win. Either they're the compromise, which is a compromised win at best, but either the compromise prevails, or the Republicans have handed them a very good issue to run on.
Well, just in closing, Harold Morrison, do you think that they're going to fold? I mean, they're not used to reality. Reality doesn't intrude on a lot of those people.
Do I think the Democrats are going to fold?
No. At this point, it's up to the House to fold, right?
I don't know. You're right. They do not live in the reality-based community. I think, but this is the kind of issue on which they can be hammered day after day in their districts. And that the Obama campaign, the DNC, the House Democratic Political Committee will do that. So I think this is one of those things that is not going to go away if they fail to reach a deal. It's just going to grow as an issue. And I think at some point the Republicans will have to fold. But when that point will come, I have no idea.
Well, thank you so much for joining us, Harold Morrison.
My pleasure. Yeah.
Again, I've been speaking with Harold Morrison, who's an opinion writer for The Washington Post, where he writes a weekly political column and is also the executive editor of The American Prospect. And previously, he was the executive editor of The LA Weekly. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll go to Seoul, South Korea to get a very different view of what makes North Korea tick.
Every crack, anybody wanna tell it like it is to each other, like you would to a sister or a brother. Cut this cosmopolitan style. And to the man who would be king, I would say only one thing. And to the man who would be king, I would say only one thing. La 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 la.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is B.R. Myers, who's a professor of international studies at Yongseo University in Busan, South Korea, and a contributing editor for The Atlantic and a columnist for The New York Times, The Wall Street Journal. He is the author of The Cleanest Race, How North Koreans See Themselves and Why It Matters. Welcome to Background Briefing, Brian Myers.
Thank you, Ian.
And you've been quoted saying that the death of Kim Jong-il, the dear leader, comes at a very bad time, in as much as what, that they haven't had sufficient time to deify the successor, who I believe is now called the great successor?
Yes. Well, words like deify, I think, are one of the reasons why the West, I think, tends to misperceive North Korea. The perception that North Korea is a kind of religious cult is a little bit off the mark, in as much as a religious cult can name a successor from one day to the next, and the people have no choice really but to accept it and will accept it. I think the Unification Church was a good example of that a few years ago. North Korea is I think, similar to even to our Western democracies in the sense that that people cannot be made to believe something completely different from one day to the next. They need time. And the propaganda apparatus has kind of dragged its feet in glorifying this young man. There's been a lot of vague praise for him for the past 2 years, but the average North Korean still does not know very much about his life. Even the mythical details of his life are just not known to people here. And I'm sure that the regime was planning to do all that next year in the context of these 100th birthday of Kim Il-sung celebrations and so on. And now they're going to have to do it much quicker, at a kind of breakneck speed. And that's going to be quite a difficult task for them, I think.
Well, the North Korean official news agency has called upon the people and the military in North Korea to revere the respected comrade. So it, I guess deified is too strong, but reverence is something that
revere, yeah, greatly respect. A lot of this language is really language that the North Koreans inherited from the colonial period. These are the kinds of verbs and terms that were used in regard to Emperor Hirohito in the 1930s and 1940s. And the North Korean party simply Koreanified them in 1948, took them over.
So, Brian Myers, you're in South Korea. What is the sense there in the air? Is there any, there's always an expectation in these transitions that conservatives will have the upper hand. Is that an expectation on the part of South Korean authorities?
Well, I don't think that people should perceive North Korea as a country where the doves are battling it out with the hawks or where the conservatives are battling it out with the reformers. It's really not that kind of a state. It's one in which the executive has really managed quite successfully to monopolize ideology. You really don't find any significant ideological daylight, so to speak, between any of the parties in North Korea. So I don't expect any big ideological shift in the weeks or months ahead.
But surely the military plays a key role, doesn't it? It's a highly militarized state, and they get the lion's share of the meager resources in a country that 10% of its population have starved while it's been able to build nuclear weapons.
Sure. My point is only that the military and the party are pretty much on the same page. Remember, the party is still in power. The phrase military first is shorthand for the party puts the military first. It's not a military-run state. It's not a junta or anything. And the military has profited quite a lot from the controlled economy. There's a second military economy, which has made very many generals rich in North Korea, and they have no reason to want to bring on some unnecessary conflict that might bring the whole regime crashing down. So I think we're going to see the kind of unity, for the most part, that the regime is calling for right now.
So if they don't want to bring on an unnecessary conflict, what would a necessary conflict be? What is the justification? I understand that the justification for this perpetual militarized state with a high level of paranoia is that they look upon the U.S. as the occupiers and they don't even consider the South Koreans a legitimate regime, and the Korean War is still in progress.
Right. Well, but again, the driving force for that is not the military, but the party and the actual leadership of the North Korean state, because that leadership is very well aware that there's really no reason for North Korea to exist as a separate state alongside South Korea, if it is not a military-first state. In other words, if North Korea were to disarm and make peace with the United States and South Korea, it would lose all reason to exist. It would simply become a third-rate version of South Korea, which is not an option for them. And I think it's very likely that they will try in the future to divert attention from their failures on the economic front by increasing tension with the outside world. And that could entail small-scale military attacks of the kind that we saw in 2010 in the Yellow Sea. I can foresee things like that happening again. I just would like to warn against the tendency of many people outside the peninsula to assume that the military is pushing all this, that these are generals who are just dying to use their weapons. And I don't think that's the dynamic that is driving things here.
So what is happening in South Korea, at Brian Myers, again, professor of international studies at Dongseo University in Busan, South Korea, the author of The Cleanest Race, How North Koreans See Themselves and Why It Matters. The conservative leadership in South Korea, I think in part, got elected on the notion that they've got nothing from the sunshine policy. It was a one-way street. And then that was reinforced, surely, by the sinking of the South Korean warship and the shelling of the South Korean island. Although there have been some gains, hasn't there, from the left in municipal elections in Seoul. So where do the politics stand?
Well, really, this is the baffling thing, I think, for Western observers, is that after each of those North Korean attacks, the opposition, the left-wing opposition, which has a very strong pro-North Korea element, won very big at the polls. The whole country really is shifting quite strongly towards the populist left at the moment. And I think this is something that needs to be factored in when people are trying to estimate the North Korean regime's chances for survival. If South Korea really were a rival state that were staking a claim to sole legitimacy over the entire peninsula with real conviction, I think the North Korean regime might be in more trouble. But you have here a South Korea that is in a deep crisis of confidence, where many people really consider North Korea to be the better of the two states.
The better of the two states? Based upon what, then?
Definitely. Based upon history, the South Korean people, particularly the intellectuals, are obsessed with the origins of the South Korean Republic, the first few years of South Korea. There's a general perception here that the country got off on a bad footing because it did not purge all the Japanese collaborators who were still in politics in the late 1940s. And a myth is quite prevalent here that North Korea made a clean break, that North Korea got rid of all its Japanese collaborators. And one of the things I've been trying to do in my research for the past few years is to point out that that's not the case, that Kim Il-sung purged landowners, but he welcomed intellectual collaborators to North Korea with open arms. And this is why the North Korean official culture that we see today, that we've been seeing for the past few days, is so similar to the official culture of Imperial Japan. The whole way in which the leader is venerated, that language that I was speaking of earlier, is language that was taken from the Japanese.
Well, you've pointed out in your latest book, The Cleanest Race, how North Koreans see themselves and why it matters, Brian Myers, that we have read the entire political complexion of North Korea incorrectly as a communist regime reposed on the left.
Right.
You're
right.
Arguing it's actually a right-wing regime.
It really is a very far-right state, and it annoys me when I keep hearing in the media broadcasts now talk about this communist North Korea. That is a word the North Koreans themselves no longer pay lip service to. They excised the last mention of it from their constitution in 2009. This is quite literally a nationalist socialist state. And if that elicits associations with the Third Reich, I'm sorry, but we have to face the facts. I would say in ideological terms, North Korea is really on the cusp between left and right. If you look at the political spectrum as a circle and not as a straight line, it's really right there on the cusp. We need, therefore, to stop extrapolating from the Cold War when we try to deal with North Korea and instead realize that it's much closer to our adversaries in the Second World War, even though it's not an expansionist nationalist state. The important thing is the implacability of its racial hatred of the outside world. This is something that is not going to change and that indeed cannot be changed without the regime losing all reason to exist.
So, Brian Myers, what explains the copious weeping in the streets and on the television announcer announcing the death of the dear leader Kim Jong? Yes,
we tend to find it very strange when people cry on the streets because a political leader has died who's ruled them for 20 years, as opposed to people crying on the street because a pop singer has died or something, which is what we do in the rational West. I think that it's natural for people to cry in a situation like this. It's not simply a matter of mourning, though. I think to a large extent it's fear of the unknown. I've talked to many South Koreans, for example, who remember crying when the South Korean dictator Park Chung-hee was assassinated in 1979. Even though they didn't like him very much personally, they were simply afraid of what was going to happen to the country in this dangerous world after it had lost its helmsman, so to speak.
So what is the role of the éminence gris, the kind of Cardinal Richelieu there? Is it Biak?
Yeah, Sang Sang-taek.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's probably going to, if there is going to be any kind of power struggle in North Korea, it's going to be a power struggle over who gets to pull the strings behind this young man, or it's going to be a sort of a wrangling for his favor. But I think for the time being, it's definitely going to be his uncle, Chang Sang-taek, who's going to be running the day-to-day affairs of the country. I simply can't imagine that this very young man knows very much about how to handle all the different affairs. Whether it stays that way or not, I don't know. But I would imagine that the young man can work himself into the post.
And both the uncle and the young Kim Jong-un have both been made generals, right?
That's right, yeah. They're both. Chang Sang-taek is in the National Defense Commission, a very top post there. But I was just looking at the news yesterday when they were announcing the the funeral proceedings, and Chang Sung-taek's name was actually quite far down the list. My guess is that they're probably going to be trying to downplay his importance to the North Korean people themselves and try to convey the impression that the young man is completely in control himself. A personality cult doesn't work otherwise.
Well, it's pretty extraordinary, though, isn't it, Brian Myers, that this very weak, isolated country, who've lost one-tenth of its population through starvation, yet manages to get the kind of attention they do. And many people argue that Kim Jong-il outfoxed George W. Bush. What explains that, the strength in their weakness?
I would agree that that he outfoxed George W. Bush, particularly in the last year of the Bush presidency, when the Americans were just desperate for a deal and the North Koreans were exploiting that to the hilt. I think the world, you know, greatly underestimated Kim Jong-il as a playboy when he first took over. And when you think of what he did with the economic cards and political cards he was played in the 1990s, he certainly turned out to be a more adept and skillful leader than his father had been. As for the success of the state, as for how it continues to survive, again, the explanation can be found in the North Korean ideology, about which far too little has been said in the past few days in the American media, the ideology of race-based nationalism. If you look at the Third Reich, for example, there was no support for surrender in the Third Reich until the very last day of the Second World War. The German people were quite willing to go right into the apocalypse because the regime had done such a good job of equating itself with the race. This is the one thing that far-right regimes do so well. And in North Korea as well, even people who don't like the regime, I found this when I was traveling through the country in June, even people who show no real enthusiasm for the regime itself are very enthusiastic about the state. They're very patriotic, in other words. And this is something I don't encounter in South Korea. When South Koreans look at their flag and their eyes well up with tears, they're thinking about the race. They're not thinking about the Republic of Korea. So in that sense, North Korea has a very strong state loyalty advantage, and I don't expect that to change in the next couple of months.
So there's no disconnect then in the people's mind between the Juche philosophy, which is one of self-reliance, and the fact that the state can't feed its own people?
Well, you know, the Juche ideology is basically a pseudo-doctrine that was cooked up in the early 1970s in order to give Kim Il-sung something else to boast about. You know, that was the time the Cultural Revolution was in full swing in China, and the North Koreans were afraid of being infected by Maoism. They were afraid their own people would start to look to Beijing for ideological guidance. And that was when this grab bag of humanist truisms was thrown together, and among them was the notion of self-reliance. But the North Koreans have never considered that to be especially important. I compare the North Korean economy always to the Japanese hikikomori, who are these young men who refuse to leave their rooms and their parents have to bring food and leave them in front of the door. North Korea is really like that. It doesn't want to be self-reliant. It wants to be isolated. And if taking international aid is going to help its isolation, it takes it very greedily. But if it needs to open up to the outside world in any way in order to improve its economy, it won't do that. So it's isolation that they want more than self-reliance. And North Korea has managed to remain very well isolated, even now with all the Chinese investment in the country. It's still pretty well sealed off from the outside world.
And you were saying earlier, Brian Myers, that in effect we've got a lot of things wrong about North Korea, but what we have also got wrong, I think, is that the assumption's always been that the South would reunify the North if the North collapsed, just as West Germany took in East Germany. But you're suggesting in a way that the North Koreans, they believe the opposite, right? That they will liberate the South, and that they've got a lot of support in the South in that kind of mythology.
Yeah, I think the North would be misperceiving South Korea if they thought that there was genuine, wide, sort of mainstream support for North Korea in the South. That's certainly not the case. The problem, though, and this was, of course, what caused the Korean War in 1950, the problem is that the North Koreans are capable of misperceiving the situation. The South Koreans in 2010, I think, really did make the mistake of conveying to North Korea an unwillingness to defend themselves. You had those two attacks, the one attack on the South Korean ship and the one attack on the populated South Korean island. Neither of them led to even a fraction of the kind of indignation that we see in North Korea whenever the Japanese make some formal reiteration of their claim to the disputed Liangkhor rocks. In other words, the South Korean people only get indignant when they feel that the race itself has been insulted by an outside power. They don't get particularly angry or indignant at the things the North Koreans do. What little anger there was after the attack on the island last year dissipated in about a week. And the problem with that, of course, is that if you're Kim Jong-un and you're sitting up there in Pyongyang surrounded by yes men and you've been raised inside this personality cult, there's a strong likelihood that you will misunderstand the South Korean situation and think that perhaps the South Korean people might not fight back. I think that's the danger, which is being overlooked a little bit too much by experts.
Well, just in closing, Brian Myers, China is always considered to be the key here if there's to be any kind of, not so much reunification, but any ending to the Korean War and a dialing down of the perennial tensions there between the two and the militarization of that border. My understanding is that the Chinese don't particularly want the North to collapse. They don't want the U.S. Army on the Yalu River. But what do they want?
They would probably like the status quo to continue indefinitely. Let's remember, China's number one task at the moment, economically speaking, is to secure resources for its people for the long term. And they've signed an awful lot of very sweet deals with North Korea, according to which they're extracting the country's very rich natural resources for a song. And the last thing they want, I think, is for the regime in North Korea to collapse. It's not just the American troops on the Yalu, but of course the refugee problem and all these things that they associate with regime collapse. And I think this is where most of our diplomatic energy and resources need to go in the future, not just America's, but South Korea's as well. They need to go towards persuading Beijing that a unified and unified Korean peninsula would not be against its interests.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us from South Korea, Brian Myers.
Sure thing, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with B.R. Myers, who's professor of international studies at Dongseo University in Busan, South Korea. He's a contributing editor for The Atlantic and a columnist for The New York Times and The Wall Street Journal. He's the author of The Cleanest Race, How North Koreans See Themselves and Why It Matters. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back in a moment talking about the real architect of the Iraq War.
After 10,000 years, it's still us against them, and my heroes have always died at the end. So who's going to account for these sins? And I don't know. I can taste the fear. Lift me up. Take me out of here. Don't wanna fight, don't wanna die. Just wanna hear you cry. Who's gonna throw the very first stone?
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Richard Bonin, who is a producer at CBS News' 60 Minutes, working with Leslie Stahl. He has won 5 Emmys as well as an Overseas Press Club Award for his reporting in Iraq. He's the author of the new book, Arrows in the Night, Ahmad Chalabi's Long Journey to Triumph in Iraq. Welcome to Background Briefing, Richard Bonin.
Thank you, Ian. Thank you for having me.
And as we witness, we have witnessed the final exit of the U.S. from Iraq, already there are signs of deep fissures and perhaps even a renewed civil war with the Sunni vice president on the lam now, being charged with terrorism. The Iraqi bloc has pulled out of the parliament. It is a mess by any measure, I think. And the consensus is, of course, that Iran is the winner of the Iraq war. And yet the neoconservative architects of this war are now claiming credit for the Arab Spring, saying that their actions in Iraq led to the Arab Spring. Where do you get a reality check in our body politics nowadays?
Yeah. Well, the bottom line, a reality check is in the Middle East, nothing is simple and nothing is easy. And, you know, trying to predict where Iraq is going to come out at this point is still too soon and too close to call. But we know for a fact that it hasn't turned out as advertised. I mean, we have 4,500 Americans dead, 100,000 Iraqis killed, upwards of $1 trillion spent. And I think the fundamental lesson of the war in Iraq is limits of power. We thought we could go in there and shape the outcome of future Iraq, a post-Saddam Iraq, and the Middle East. And we know, whatever our intentions, no matter how noble they may have been or misguided, we're simply unable to do so. And there are forces at play in Iraq in particular, in the Middle East in general, that we don't understand completely. And to the extent that we do, we're unable to control. And we're seeing that across the Middle East and in Iraq.
But one thing that's been haunting us for some time is why we went into the Iraq war, because there's never been a straight answer. You know, Greenspan said it was oil. Bush said it was democracy. It's changed a lot.
Weapons of mass destruction.
Mass destruction was the excuse. I mean, right. You know, there's a list of particulars. But what is so important about your book, Richard Bone, In Arrows in the Night, Ahmad Chalabi's Long Journey to Triumph in Iraq, is that it really does make pretty clear, and it's astounding when you think about it, that one man conned the greatest power on earth into a war that Martin Van Creewald, the Israeli historian, referred to as the greatest strategic mistake since Emperor Augustus invaded Germany in 9 AD.
Well, the astonishing thing is, to the extent Ahmad Chalabi conned us, he did it with our eyes wide open. You know, what he did is he came to this country in the 1990s. He had just fled Jordan, just fled a conviction for bank fraud in which he was sentenced to more than 20 years in hard labor. And he came to America where he had no constituency. He had no contacts in the Iraqi army. He had no political base in Iraq. He had no support in Washington. The Clinton White House was against him. The CIA was against him. The State Department was against him. And he systematically courted people of power and the levers of power in this country until he built a climate of opinion that made regime change in Iraq not only intellectually acceptable, but desirable. He systematically stoked the desire for regime change in Iraq over a 10-year period. And so when 9/11 happened, there was already a huge amount of steam built behind the idea of overthrowing Saddam. And he, you know, and his key partner, I mean, he had several sponsors throughout, first the CIA, then members of Congress, in particular the conservative leadership, and then ultimately the neoconservatives. And the neoconservatives had their own reasons, their own vision for post-Saddam Iraq. Chalabi had his. And when they met each other in the mid-1990s, they both saw in each other a way forward, the way forward. So the neocons wanted to go in. Chalabi wanted to go in, and he needed them, and they needed him. And why they needed him is because here they were advocating the overthrow of Saddam. And as Richard Pearl told me, probably the leading neoconservative advocate for the overthrow of Saddam, what Pearl told me is, you know, if we are a bunch of Americans advocating regime change in Iraq, you have to answer the question, well, after Saddam's gone, what's next? Who's next? And for them, Ahmad Chalabi was the answer. And once they had that piece of the puzzle, then they could move forward and make the case.
Well, he certainly saw himself as the leader, and of course it didn't transpire, and then he turned around and betrayed us to Iran. But just to go back to the extraordinary revelations in your book, Arrows in the Night, Richard Bone, on day two of the Bush presidency, that's January the 21st of 2001, a meeting took place at Richard Pearl's home with Paul Wolfowitz, Zalman Khalilzad, Doug Feist, Paul Wolfowitz,
all of the
John Hanna,
Pearl, of course,
yeah.
All of whom would soon and John Hanna, all of whom would soon have leading positions in the Bush administration. John Hanna as a Middle East advisor to Vice President Cheney. And, of course, Wolfowitz and Feist as the number two and three people at the Pentagon, and Richard Pearl as a senior advisor to both Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld and Wolfowitz. And finally, Zal Khalilzad as a special advisor to President Bush himself. They were all there on the day after Bush's inauguration, Richard Perle convenes the meeting, and he says, we have won. Now it is time to get our policy enacted. And the policy was regime change in Iraq and replacing Saddam with their friend Ahmad Chalabi.
And the meeting was largely about him?
It was exclusively about him. It was exclusively about setting the stage, plotting their method for getting President Bush to adopt the policy of regime change in Iraq, and not only getting rid of Saddam, but then replacing Saddam with Chalabi. I mean, throughout the Clinton years, the 1990s, the idea of regime change in Iraq was a non-starter. And before Clinton, with Bush the father, George H.W. Bush, the idea of regime change was a non-starter, obviously. I mean, first President Bush, you know, had 700,000 troops on the doorsteps of Baghdad and decided to leave Saddam in power.
They understood the broader strategic and geopolitical reality, didn't they, that he was a check and balance against Iran?
Yes, they did. Saddam, nobody fooled themselves. Saddam was a brutal, evil dictator, but geostrategically, he was a bulwark against the spread of Iranian influence throughout the rest of the Middle East. And at bottom, you know, the issue was oil. And what Chalabi figured out was the fault line between in U.S. foreign policy between our values as a people and our interests as a country. And for decades, starting with Kissinger and Nixon through Clinton, we valued stability and the free flow of oil from the Middle East to the West and Japan over democracy and the freedom of the Iraqi people. And as a people ourselves, that's difficult to swallow. But at the same time, overthrowing Saddam incurred huge geopolitical risks. And that's why I said at the beginning of this interview, what we've learned is the limits of power and the limits of our power to shape the outcome of an adventure like this. We thought we could overthrow Saddam and keep things in place. And as we've now discovered, you know, the whole Middle East is up for grabs.
Well, I would say that when you say we thought we could, I mean, it largely was the Bush
policymakers. George W. Bush administration.
Exactly,
right?
Because his own father and Brent Scowcroft warned against it for the very reasons that you've just stated.
And you know, the point I strayed from is, I mean, originally George W. Bush campaigned against nation building, campaigned against the very notion of what he would eventually do in March of 2003, invade Iraq. And so when Richard Perle and Chalabi and Wolfowitz and Feith and Hanna met at Perle's house on the second day of the Bush presidency, what the challenge ahead of them was to get President Bush himself to make a U-turn on his own vision and his own campaign promises against regime change, against nation building in a country like Iraq. So that was what was at the heart of their meeting on the second day of the Bush presidency.
And it's worth noting that on the day that President Bush finally got out of Air Force One after 9/11 and met at Camp David, on that first meeting after the United States had been struck by al-Qaeda, Wolfowitz brings up an invasion of Iraq. And Richard Berman, just moving, because there's so much more to talk about here, moving to the actual invasion of Iraq, Rumsfeld, Powell, Tenet and company, they opposed Chalabi's idea of creating a provisional government with him at the head in Iraq. And is that the point where Chalabi then decides to court the Iranians, or was he already in touch with the Iranians?
No, he was already deeply ensconced with the Iranians. I mean, Chalabi's genius was from early on, he realized the road to Baghdad went through Washington, but he had to court Iran at the same time. And while he is courting the neoconservatives in Washington, he is insinuating himself at an ever higher level within the political and intelligence circles of the Iranian government. So by time the U.S. invasion occurs, I mean, Chalabi is meeting with the head of the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps and all the top policymakers inside Iran. And what happened was, in Washington, there was a huge policy debate about what to do after the fall of Saddam. Everyone knew the fall of Saddam was certain and would be swift. The question is the day after. And the policy debate was whether the U.S. would occupy the country or turn it over to a provisional government led by Ahmad Chalabi. And that debate played out for months and months and months, and with the State Department, the CIA, much of the National Security Council against the Chalabi plan, and Paul Wolfowitz, Doug Feith inside the Pentagon basically pushing the provisional government plan.
So when the U.S. finds out that Chalabi has given away one of the most important secrets that the U.S. had, which is that it had broken Iran's communication code and was reading all of its mail, including communications between Baghdad and Tehran, that's when, of course, Bush gets really angry. But even then, the Pentagon, I guess Wolfowitz and Feith and company, keep stonewalling. And only after this treachery is revealed do they cut off their 10-year relationship with Chalabi's INC, which had received up to then $33 million in U.S. taxpayer money. When did he actually betray the U.S. to the Iranians in terms of telling them that we had intercepted Iran's secret code?
Well, you know, according to the multiple sources I interviewed, including non-CIA sources, I mean, Chalabi gave up the secret in the spring of 2004. He met with the head of the IRGC, this fellow named Soleimani, and the head of the Iranian government's station in Baghdad. And he and Chalabi and his aide told them that our NSA, the National Security Administration, had cracked their most secret code. It was the one code where the Iranians communicated worldwide in unguarded language, and including communicating information about terrorist attacks, whether it be in Lebanon or IED attacks and attacks against U.S. soldiers in Iraq. I mean, we had cracked that code and were able to read their most sensitive mail. And according to several of my sources, that is what Chalabi gave up in the spring of 2004. And the amazing thing is, when the head of the NSA explained that to President Bush at an Oval Office meeting, President Bush ordered, you know, ties with Chalabi cut off, to stop the flow of money, and it took three different meetings in the White House, three different orders by President Bush to sever relations with Chalabi before before the administration finally did so. And this, you know, comes from several sources, including one of whom is on the record, a man named Rob Richer, who is the director, who is our top spy in the Middle East. He was the director of clandestine operations in Iraq during the war. And he was sitting in the Oval Office when all of this was going down. And, you know, he said he had never seen anybody stonewall, drag their feet, slow roll an order by the commander-in-chief, especially in the time of war. It was shocking to them, and to him, to Rob Richer, it was evidence of the depth to which these neoconservatives were committed, not only to Chalabi, but to their idea of post-Saddam Iraq.
And the amazing thing is, Richard Bonin, that the Chalabi, despite the fact that he betrayed the U.S. in such a fundamental way, he then is invited back in by Ryan Crocker and General Petraeus, and he betrays us again and directly causes the death of, you know, hundreds of American soldiers through the Sardis unit, didn't he? I mean...
Yeah, well, what happened is, during the height of the Civil War in Iraq, 2006, 2007, when it looked like the whole thing was going to unravel and just become an unmitigated disaster akin to the end of the Vietnam War with the helicopter taking off of the embassy roof, when it looked like we were heading in that direction... Our policymakers were desperate to work with anybody who could salvage the situation. And whatever you say about Chalabi, the man is brilliant, and he is very Western in his ability to get things done. It's very hard, you know, after decades of dictatorship in Iraq. It's very hard to get people to take initiative and get things done. Chalabi is very good at that. And they reached out to him and made him a part of the counterinsurgency, improving basic services in Iraq, and brought him back into the tent. And just when it looked like he was about to consolidate his comeback with the Americans, according to people in the know, he... betrayed the U.S. again. We were locked in a deadly battle with the Shia militia run by Muqtada al-Sadr. This was in Basra in the south and in Sadr City right outside of Baghdad. And it looked like for a while Muqtada al-Sadr's Shia militia, which is backed by Iran, was about to win in those two cities in this armed conflict. Just brutal. And we were on the verge the Iraqi government of Maliki was on the verge of collapsing, and Chalabi was secretly egging on Muqtada al-Sadr's militia to keep the fight up while talking to Tehran and saying, listen, when the Maliki government falls, remember who your friends are, and basically lobbying for himself to become the prime minister of Iraq should the Maliki government fall. And our U.S. intelligence sources picked up that communication, and that was it. Then the end of the U.S.-Chalabi relationship was final. You know, as far as they're concerned, he's dead to them.
Deal
with him at all.
Talk about American blood on his hands, and not to mention the treasure that he received directly. It's just an extraordinary story that you've brought forth here, Richard Bone. And just in closing, though, you spent, 60? You met him with 60 times, is that right?
No, I first met him shortly after the attacks of 9/11 in January of 2002. So I've known him for about 10 years. But for the book, I interviewed him for 60 hours.
60 hours, sorry.
On tape, right. And then many, many hours off tape.
So where is this guy today? He should be hanging beside Saddam Hussein, but he's not. So
you can't be... I find it difficult to be completely that harsh on Chalabi. You have to remember, he, for whatever his reasons, he opposed Saddam Hussein against his own interests, and he has... survived about a dozen assassination attempts, and there is a degree of nobility in taking on Saddam Hussein, who after all murdered probably about a million Iraqis, gassed them, murdered them, his soldiers raped their women. I mean, it was an evil regime, and there is a degree of nobility in opposing Saddam. But Chalabi is ultimately out for himself, and he, in his heart of hearts, believes what's best for him is best for Iraq. The CIA did a psychoanalysis of him, like they do all political leaders, and they concluded that he is a narcissist. He is literally unable to separate in his mind his own interests from those of Iraq, and so he is constantly pursuing his own interests, and sometimes they smack of amorality, and I think that's why he, in the end, he had so much opposition against him inside the U.S. government.
Well, maybe I should revise my death wish for him and suggest that Pearl and Wolfowitz and all the neocons get strung up because they allowed this country to be conned by this person who was so mendacious and so duplicitous. At any rate, we've run out of time, but I really recommend your book, Harley, because as now we witness the end of our sorry chapter in Iraq, this is important information. This really explains how we got into this war and why.
And well, thank you for your time, Ian. I appreciate it.
Again, I've been speaking with Richard Bonin, his producer at CBS News, 60 Minutes, working with Leslie Stahl. He's won 5 Emmys as well as an Overseas Press Club Award for his reporting in Iraq. He's the author of the new book, Arrows in the Night, Ahmed Chalabi's Long Journey to Triumph in Iraq. So what do we learn from today's background briefing? We began talking with a columnist with the Washington Post and executive editor of the American Prospect, Harold Meyerson, giving us an update on the House Republicans' latest example of bullheaded brinkmanship and this kind of slash-and-burn ideological approach that they have where compromise is impossible and they'll have a tantrum until they get all of their demands met and they'll even shut down the entire U.S. government. In this case, they will deny unemployment benefits to millions of Americans and a tax cut to 160 million Americans. So that is where we're at in Washington. And, of course, the Democrats, feckless as they are, have fallen for taking the payment of this extension of unemployment and payroll tax cut. They took off the table their insistence that it get paid for with a surtax on millionaires and billionaires. The Republicans have been able to use this leverage of the Keystone Pipeline, which is entirely designed to distract the public from their real fealty to the billionaires who they'll go to the mat for. And in general, it is yet another disgrace, but of course it's a self-inflicted wound on the Republicans, and they probably will come out the losers with this one. It's not a Democratic victory, it's a Republican loss. And then we talked about what really is the true nature of the regime in North Korea. The CIA doesn't know a damn thing about the place, and most of what you read in the press is nonsense. And this Brian Myers, professor of international studies at Dongseo University in Busan, South Korea, the author of The Cleanest Race, How North Koreans See Themselves and Why It Matters, really does explain what the true nature of that regime is, that it's not a far-left communist regime. It's more like a right-wing fascist monarchy like Imperial Japan was under Emperor Hirohito. And once you understand the national socialist nature, the Nazi nature of this regime, they're not expansionists. They don't want to take over the world. But they are a race-based culture. Then it begins to make sense, all of the weeping in the street and the worship of the great leader, the dear leader, and now the great, or the dear successor, I guess he's called, or the great successor. And then finally, we spoke with Richard Bonin, a 60 Minutes producer, who's written this brilliant book, Arrows in the Night, Ahmed Chalabi's Long Journey to Triumph in Iraq. This really explains what the Iraq War is all about and how this amazing crook conned the U.S. into this disastrous war, all the while working for the Iranians. It's an amazing story. This has been Background Briefing. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasts, and you can sign up there at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.